You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do. So she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode was made possible by the support of our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the Mythcreens Podcast. I'm Oren. With me today is...
Wes.
And...
Chris.
And today we are talking about child characters because I have been told enough times that I cannot simply have all of my characters spring into the world as fully formed adults, and that despite what I might wish, children do exist and maybe sometimes should be in stories.
maybe sometimes,
grump, grump,
yes.
Grump, grump, grump. Grump, grump, grump. Get off my lawn, kids.
Grumps, get out of my grumps, story.
Don't worry, guys. If I run out of material, I'm just going to start reading from the Chris Winkle's excellent post on depicting child characters. This Chris Winkle seems like she knows what she's talking about. We should get her on the post sometime.
I may or may not have stolen material from her when preparing for this podcast.
We're all just a bunch of plagiarists here.
I was going to say, so by child, you don't mean teenagers, right?
No, I think that, like, I mean, where you define the start of teenager is going to be different and somewhat arbitrary, but I think that in general, there is a difference between writing child characters and writing teenage characters.
Agreed.
Yeah, I think it is a little blurry, though, and I think when I look through most of the child protagonists and stories, they are actually, I would say, more towards the teenage end, because... When we think about ages, I think it's easy for adults to underestimate how fast kids develop. And honestly, mm-hmm. by the time the kid is 10, they resemble a teenager more than they resemble a small child.
That's true.
And I think that 10-year age, there's just a lot of protagonists that are about that age, like Harry Potter, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And again, they're not really like... children as much anymore. If you actually look at the development rates, you know, they're doing long division. You know, they're
I
not...
can't do long division.
they're reading novels, novels for children, but still novels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not, they're youthful and they have kind of a youthful attitude, but they're not like still in the same level of like development, you know, that a younger child goes through, where they're still learning their, you know, fine motor control and speaking skills,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing.
But also...
So this is very interesting because it's like, okay, so Harry Potter starts the story when he is basically 11, right? I think it starts on his 11th birthday. But he definitely acts more like a teenager, whereas the Holy Grail of all storytelling, which is called Stranger Things,
mm-hmm.
Has four characters who are, I think, all between 12 and 13, who I would say definitely seem to fall more on the child end of things.
I mean, I think they might be a little bit young, but I don't think too young. I mean, I think one of the things that distinguishes the... Possibly they're acting more like they're 10 or 11, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that once you get to about the 10-year age, you start to see is... the almost teen-like social cohesion, where they now have social groups and peer pressure and things like that. And
right.
You definitely see that in Stranger Things. You know, we start, they have a role-playing group, you know, together,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that kind of preteen era. So they might be a little in the young side, but I don't see too different from Harry Potter, I guess.
I was thinking, I mean, the importance of that, I mean, regardless, like, of the actual age or grade, like, you know, they work best when they're that range because they're going through a transition, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, and like that, storytellers can go to the well of, you know, oncoming adolescents for anything to include in their stories anytime they want at that point. Like, this, the nature of like going from a child to a teen or a teen to an adult, like all of those like points are really blurry, and so you can kind of introduce things whenever, you know, it suits your story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also just easier,
yeah,
to incorporate more mature adult characters than it is children, right? To try to, especially if you have a protagonist, you know, trying to think about like, okay, what, my protagonist is 6 years old, you know, what can, mm-hmm. you know, what can my protagonist do? That's hard. It's difficult. And making the child just a little older, you know, really helps take care of that problem. I think a good example of, and I don't actually know how old this character is, but it certainly seems younger, is actually Alice in Alice in Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where, you know, what Alice does to get involved in the story is just chase a rabbit. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very youthful activity. I think Alice comes off as significantly younger and more youthful than the majority of child protagonists that we have.
Yeah, okay, so what defines the difference between Harry Potter and Stranger Things for me is that the characters in Harry Potter, although they are young, they pretty much know what's going on. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, they figure out that there is a Sorcerer's Stone and that Voldemort wants it. And they're wrong about who Voldemort is working with. They think he's working with Snape. But like, they think that for perfectly rational reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they pretty much have everything figured out. Whereas the characters in Stranger Things, like towards the very end, they get an accurate picture of what's happening. But for most of that story, they are only dealing with like, you know, pieces of it, and they're like kind of trying to fit it into their worldview and having a hard time, like, you know, they don't know for sure what's going on. They certainly don't get like the full extent of like that there's a government conspiracy. And maybe that's a question of a difference between a story that's about kids for kids versus a story that's about kids for adults.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah.
Maybe that's where the distinction lies.
Yeah. I mean, this is something I wanted to mention because that is a huge difference. And I think, in Stranger Things, not only is it a show for adults, but there's also adult protagonists. And so in mm-hmm. Stranger Things, they have three different groups of protagonists. They have the adults, the teenagers, and the kids. And they split them up and each tackle the problem from a different direction. So it's almost like the youngest group, they don't have to fully understand the conspiracy because that's what the adults are studying,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whereas Harry Potter is for children, and there's no adults tackling the problem, it's just the kids. So they have to understand it at a much deeper level. Ultimately, the big difference between writing kids for kids and writing kids for adults is that writing kids for kids is a lot about wish fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what a child audience wants is different from a story is different than what an adult audience wants. Children really want wish fulfillment in their stories. Very much so. Mm-hmm. And Harry Potter is designed to give that to them. About an ordinary, very relatable boy who then finds out that he's a wizard and he gets to go to magic school. Mm-hmm. That entire premise is set up for wish fulfillment. And if you see, like, for instance, movies that are for a kid audience, you know, some of them seem very absurd to adults because the kids just ridiculously outshine their parents and, you know, are overcompetent, and that to an adult audience, that is silly, that is not believable, that's not fun to watch. But to a child audience, that is wish fulfillment. It is very fun to watch. It is very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly knowing who you're writing for is really important here.
Yeah, great point.
Right. And I mean, like, that's sort of one of the biggest problems with child protagonists is, like, only a problem if you're writing the story for adults, which is the question of why are adults not solving this problem?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're writing it for kids, frankly, the kids don't care. I mean, when I read Harry Potter for the first time, I did have some criticisms of it, but one of my criticisms was not, why aren't the adults solving this problem? Because at that point, when I was young enough to be reading those books for the first time, I just took it as a given that adults would not step in and do anything, because you can't trust adults. Mm-hmm. If you need something done right, you have a kid do it.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I will say that some stories for kids are designed so that their parents will also like the story. Because that,
yeah.
You know, It's like, it's the whole family movie idea. It's like, you want, or the Sesame Street. Sesame Street specifically designed so that there are inside jokes that will make it so that parents don't mind watching it with their children.
Mm-hmm.
Because you'll get a bigger child audience if the parents are along for the ride and having a good time, right? And I think, you know, giving reasons why the adults are not helping that doesn't make the adults look completely incompetent is good for that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's always like, it's one of those things where if you can have both of them, you definitely should.
Mm-hmm.
But a, like, you know, Stranger Things, the fact that Stranger Things is able to manage to have the children, what they do, be important without making the adults look incompetent is really impressive and has to do with, like, a very, very careful, like, siloing of information and who knows what at what time, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's a very delicate balancing act, and I'm very worried about what they're going to do in season two. Ironically, by the time this goes out, season two will already have come out, so I will know.
Show notes?
Show notes, yeah. Sure. But I, you know, I still, you know, but I'm concerned, and that's, you know, that's something that is very hard to balance. If you want a story that is either for adults or a story that adults will enjoy, that's like one of the first things you have to think about is why are the adults not solving this problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a lot easier. Again, Stranger Things is a horror story that is for adults. But in a lot of these stories with child protagonists, I think that it really helps to keep the stakes lower. You know, because the more the stakes are lower, the more you can excuse the adults not making an extra effort to help or the kids not making extra effort to ask the adults for help.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that can be used with additional reasons. Like, for instance, you know, the idea that the adults might not believe the kids. Because, you know, when you've got speculative fiction, something wild happens, the kids go to the adults, the adults just think they're making it up. That only stretches right. So far. If your stakes are low and there's not obviously a huge pressing problem, it's a lot mm-hmm. easier to get away with that than it is if you have really big stakes in life or death scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the trick, I think, to the not believing thing is just to keep it brief. You know, it's not good for repeatedly using it in a longer story. It works better for shorter stories where there's just one conversation and there's not a lot of evidence and, you know, because usually you still want your parents to be, usually, in, you know, you want your parents to not be just jerks.
Right. You know, if you want the adults to enjoy the story, right?
Yeah. Stranger
and like,
yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say another option is to pull the children into the magic world. And part of, like, to a certain extent, I think, like, they're, like, audiences are primed to accept that magic worlds are for children and that, like, adults can't go into them. And I mean, you know, that probably says a lot about the way we view childhood versus adulthood, but that is, regardless of the underlying factors, that is something that that audiences will readily accept. So if you want your child character to be, like, you know, important and doing these adventures in the land of fairy, it's, you know, if they fall through portals into fairy, it's like, audiences will accept pretty quickly that their parents can't follow them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, you know, as long as through the magic, they get back before dinner time, it's like, yeah, it's probably fine, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing that Stranger Things uses is the idea that adults wouldn't approve of what the kids are doing, so then the kids don't ask them for help. Right. Mm-hmm. The kids know that they're not supposed to be hiding 11 in their homes, the strange girl in their homes, and so they just keep it a secret.
Mm-hmm.
And that keeps them from getting help.
Right, and especially since, like, you know, they make the kids know that, like, the kids find out early that if, like, that calling the police would be bad because, like, they would do bad things to 11.
Mm-hmm.
And they also establish that, like, the kids' parents are super conformist and would be like, we will let the proper authorities handle this. And so, you know, as always, the real enemy is capitalism.
But yeah, I mean, and of course you can always damsel the adults, you know, in stories that are really focused on kids. Mm-hmm. Coraline does that. Her parents are kidnapped and then she has to do things to rescue them.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
In the right story, that works out really well.
Yeah, a problem that so this is a problem that I see, but it's hard to define and harder still to know what to do about it, which is, like, at what point does your child character just start acting like a short adult?
Right.
Yeah.
And like, the ocean at the end of the lane feels a lot like that because it has two child characters, one of whom is the point of view character who basically does nothing.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically a floating camera. And then the other one is the witch girl. And frankly, she strikes me like an adult.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she feels like an adult who is slightly shorter than average, and has all this magic. And I'm not really sure, like, how to define when that starts and what to do about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's complicated because kids do mature at different rates. Like, you know, for instance, up until 9 years old, just the rate at which they develop, you know, and basically turn into adults is very different from kid to kid. And then even at, you know, teenager rates, just the level of maturity from teenager to teenager is just, like, wildly different. And so... Mm-hmm.
That's true.
I wouldn't say that having a really mature teenager who, like, if you just talk to, you wouldn't even know was a teenager is something that is just unrealistic because there's just too much variety for that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like to focus on the things that young people and kids struggle with that adults don't have to deal with. Like, for young kids, there's a big issue of, you know, they basically almost, like, have a youth disability where mm-hmm. they can't do certain things because either they don't have the fine motor skills or things are too big. You know, they're mm-hmm. designed for adults, you know, and so they can't do some basic tasks that adults can do for themselves, and that's a frustrating thing that they deal with. You know,
mm-hmm.
The dealing with having a parent or another authority figure is something that any young person has to deal with. You know, going through some adolescent changes is a stressful period. And I think looking at some of those kind of challenges and difficulties that young people face that usually adults are past at a certain point is a good way to make them feel more like they are their age without kind of getting in the trap of making them, like, overly, you know, underdeveloped or immature or... Because, again, we tend to underestimate how well-developed kids are, except for when it comes to drawing. all the drawings you see in movies are from way older kids. Like, a young kid can't make the, you know, the stereotypical, like, sun that's, like, a circle with, like, lines and then, like, a house and stick figures. Like, that's probably from, like, a 12-year-old or something. Or, you know, maybe not 12, but, like, you know, the 6-year-old kid that picture's always shown with, they cannot make those pictures. They do not have the fine motor control for those drawings.
I mean, I can't do those drawings now, so, you know.
yeah. But it's easy to forget that, like, you know, a 1-year-old is walking and talking. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Wait, no, really? No.
Yes.
No. Yeah. A 1-year-old is like...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, is it a 1-year-old like that? Like, I don't... Like, they just got born, right?
No.
Like, they're basically still in the hospital.
No, they're walking
point, right?
and talking.
No? Oh, gosh. My worldview, it is
so
destroyed.
Kids speak in complete sentences around, like, 3 years old, and complex sentences are at around 5.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Mm.
Yeah, but they are actually saying words and walking around at 1. They still look super tiny. But, again, that's really easy for us as adults to look at and think that young people are much less developed than they actually are, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, I think defining, like, the struggles is a good way to try to avoid the trap of making them seem overly young.
Can I talk about a weird edge case?
Sure.
About child characters. So this is something to watch out for when you are writing a story that features both a child and the adult that child becomes. And it's, again, it's a little bit hard to define, but I have occasionally read stories where it feels like the adult is not the same person. Even though, like, obviously by some definitions they wouldn't be, because you change a lot between being a child and being an adult, right? But there's still, like, it can create a disconnect, or at least it does for me. In one book, there's some mild spoilers here for the Southern Reach trilogy, but I'll keep them very mild. In the last book, Acceptance, you have a like in flashback form, you see the director of the Southern Reach, which is this like clandestine spy operation, as a child, and then you see her later as an adult. And the child version of her is like the super stoic, too cool for school, nothing bothers me, I have an answer for everything character archetype. And maybe that's a bit of a cliche anyway, but that's what she is. Whereas the adult version is like completely like lost and I don't know what's going on, I don't know what to do, I'm taking a stab in the dark. And maybe that was the intent. Maybe the idea was to show how she changed when she became an adult, but it felt like it wasn't the same person. Like, it was hard for me to conceive that this kid grew up into this adult.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure how to deal with that.
Yeah.
It's just a weird thing.
Well, I think it's hard if you don't, if you're doing a flashback and then a flash forward, it's hard if you don't see the character change, right? Mm-hmm. And some writers definitely fall into the trap of having the massive character change happen off screen. And then, like, start the sequel, and the character's totally different. And it's like that.
Yeah.
That character change is juicy, and the audience should see it. To what extent, ever extent is practical, they should see it happening. What was the sequences when she was a kid? What was the perspective on that? Was that, like, was it her as an adult narrating being a kid, or?
No, it was the perspective of another character, an adult character that, like, she hung out with.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I think that would make it a lot harder, because at least, if you have a adult narrator narrating themselves as a child, which I think is one of the best ways to do it, because, again, narration has its own difficulties when you have a child protagonist. But when you have an adult first-person narrator or narrating about when they were a kid, it's really easy to add in some of that context of, like, oh, gosh, I remember being like this when I was a kid. I was so sure of myself then. You know, and I think that will feel a lot more natural than this outside perspective, right?
Yeah.
And it also avoids the problem of having to narrate in a child's voice, which, again, like, I think the only reason to narrate in child's voice is if you really want what is basically an unreliable narrator. You know, you want that narrator to reflect an incomplete understanding, you know, a child's understanding of the world. Otherwise, it's just hard and it's not giving you any benefit. So that would be my opinion, but I think that is a little difficult. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like when they get a child actor or an adult actor in a movie, it's always difficult.
Oh, gosh. Supernatural had that problem so bad. What was weird... Okay, so Supernatural, at least in the seasons of it that I watched, it has a lot of flashbacks to Sam and Dean, the main characters, as kids. And they never feel right. Like, in fact, they don't... I mean, part of the problem is that they clearly didn't spend their budget hiring good child actors.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there was one weird exception. There's an episode where Dean meets up with with an old girlfriend who has a kid, and, like, part of the question of the episode is, like, is the kid his? And the child actor did a great job of acting like Dean's son. Which was weird because the premise is that this kid had never met Dean before, and I was like, I'm not really convinced that an attitude could be genetically inherited like that. I mean, I know we inherit some behavioral traits from our parents, but that seemed like a lot. But regardless, they clearly told the child actor to, like, act like this dude, but a kid, and he did a super good job. I was really impressed. I was like, I totally believe that's Dean's kid. It turned out not to be, spoilers. But...
Yeah, I think one of the biggest difference with, you know, if the adult is actually raising the kid or not is actually in what the kid says, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, again, we have this idea of a child of being, you know, using only, like, simple words. But it's not really true. Children use the words that the people around them use, right? And it's just that their frame their knowledge is so much more based on what they have been personally exposed to in their life, and that's a much smaller set. But if their parents are always, like, using, like, you know, really complex words around them, you can expect them to repeat those words. And so having some of the same, like, phrasing as their parents, you know, even incorrectly applied to the wrong situation would be like, but it would be weird if you saw that and, you know, the parent had not actually raised that kid.
See, this is why around kids, I only speak in newspeak from George Orwell's Brave New World. Just because I want to, it's like my own sociology experiment, you know? I just want to see how many kids I can get to say double plus good.
So, Wes, do you have any favorite examples of child protagonists you want to talk about?
I guess that depends on... that goes crosses like books and genres and things. Probably like the most powerful short story that had a child protagonist. And I talked about this short story like way long ago on the podcast, but James Joyce's Araby, I think, does a really good job of a boy kind of on the cusp. You know, he's probably, I think he's in some, maybe like fifth grade. So right, he's around like 11, and he kind of starts getting infatuated with his friend's sister. And like the whole point of the short story is that he gets this idea in his head about like, if he only goes to this one place to get this one thing, then maybe she would like him, right? And as like adults reading this, like you just kind of see it coming. But like when the kid at the end of the story has that realization of like what he's doing, and like a really like grown up moment of like, it's like vanity, it's weird, why have I done this? Like that hit home, because I think like as an adult reading a story about a kid that was written for adults, we can all remember going back and being in that person's shoes, right? Where like, you know, like you look behind the veil and you see what like adulthood really is, and you're like, oh no. It's not all that bleak, but
yeah, this sounds like a really like wow, this sounds like an intense story the way you're describing
it. I mean, it's very powerful, it's very good. It's in his collection of short stories called Dubliners, and it's kind of, I think there's 12 and they're in groups of four, I think, that are like kind of parts of like adult like of life. So the first three or four stories focus on much younger like narrators, and then they get older as like the stories progress. Not necessarily the same ones, but just like sketches in life in Dublin from the 19th century. But another one that I really like is a Ray Bradbury novel called Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Oh, I've never actually read that.
Yes, that is fun. That is about a horrifying nightmare circus that comes to town, and protagonists Will Holloway and Jim Nightshade go for the ride of their lives.
Jim Nightshade.
Yeah,
huh?
Jim Nightshade.
Is he a friend of Wraith McBlade?
What's fun about those two, and like Jim kind of has like some narrative perspective for a bit, but mostly it's from Will's perspective. But Will's dad is also one of the main characters in that story. And kind of like what we talked about with Stranger Things, it's like what Will and Jim know about what's happening with this weird circus isn't quite the same what Will's dad is starting to find out about what's going on with the presence of this weird circus in town. But like, it's what the dad's role is kind of interesting, because he is kind of that like disillusioned adult who like sees like hope in the kids, but like grows as much as they do by like figuring out like how to work with them. And like, I don't know, it's interesting, right? Because like we like stories about kids because of like the nostalgia factor, and this story like kind of literally it's written into it. With like the dad like kind of wanting to go hang out with Will and Jim and just like not have to worry about his job, you know, because he's not like getting fulfilled on certain levels. It's a pretty fun one. There's a great scene where Will takes on a witch that still is kind of pretty chilling, so I recommend that one for sure.
Right. Well, my favorite child character is probably the Anointed One from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. As we all know, he turned out to be a really challenging, threatening villain, right? No, okay. I actually do really like Naomi Wildman from Voyager, even though she ages like a magic plot device, because she goes from being a baby to being like 10.
I swear, every single speculative fiction story that ever introduces a baby ever just has to use magic or technology or something to make that child, that baby, suddenly be an adult. I cannot count the number of times this has happened. Mm-hmm. It's just like, just let it be a baby, okay? Just
let it be a baby. You know, the one time they actually did that was Molly in DS9.
Mm. No! No, they have an episode where she becomes an adult.
Well, right, but they undo it. Okay. Like, what I mean, like, there's a one-off where she's an adult, but that's like a what-if scenario. Like, Molly is born as a baby in TNG, and then through the course of TNG and Deep Space Nine, ages like a baby, like a regular person, and is, you know, a young girl at the end of Deep Space Nine. But, I mean, granted, she's also not very important to the story, right? Whereas... Mm-hmm. Naomi Wildman, even though she ages like a magic plot device, and goes from like a baby to being 10 in 3 years, and then doesn't age after that, I still like her because she like is, you know, she kind of breathes a bit of fresh air into Voyager in the same way that Seven of Nine did, mm-hmm. Like a season earlier,
mm-hmm.
Because you know Voyager had a tendency to be like kind of depressing, honestly. Like there are a lot of really like sort of sad Voyager episodes where it's like, oh, they tried to get home. Oh, their dreams were crushed again. Mm-hmm. Right? Or like, oh, man, that was a terrible planet. Let's just keep Let's going. Go. We can't fix that problem. Bye, terrible planet. And, you know, like, there was a lot of that in Voyager. And, like, having Naomi around was just kind of nice. Gave her, like, you know, gave us some fun character interactions and, like, no one was mean to her, which was another problem that Voyager had, was that a lot of its character interactions were actually very mean, even though the writers never, I don't think, realized it.
Yeah.
But, you know, when Naomi and Seven hang out, it's, like, it's just adorable, right? No one's, she's never trying to tell Seven what to do and, like, how to be a human and all that whatever. No, they just have fun, okay? They can just have fun and be friends, and it's great. Yeah. I love those scenes.
How,
yeah.
I was gonna say, in Next Generation, how old is Wesley supposed to be?
He is the age of the Wonder Kid, of right. course. I think he's supposed to be 12 when the show yeah. starts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or maybe 14. I don't know. He was, and to be fair, I've just said this before, Wesley worked when I was a kid, right? When I was 14 and I started watching The Next Generation, I was into Wesley as a mm-hmm. character. Yeah. I was like, yeah, that's my
Me
favorite.
Me too. That's probably when I started watching Generation. I also loved Wesley. When I was, you know, 12 or something.
Mm-hmm.
We've all made bad choices.
I will say about Naomi Wildman is, I think that what you said really reflects one of the strengths that you can give child characters that aren't always taken advantage of. Like, you know, when children, no matter how young they are, they have certain instincts. And some of those instincts are actually reading emotions in other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like... kids can see when somebody's upset and they can comfort them. You know, they can have strong social attributes that lets them actually be supportive of other characters, you know, and maybe they don't have the knowledge to support other characters, you know, through expertise or the physical abilities to, you know, defend and battle other characters, but they can emotionally support other characters. And I think Naomi Wildman definitely provides some of that in Voyager.
All right, well, we are actually out of time, but I agree with you, Chris. That was a good point about Naomi. Those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythgreens.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week.
If this episode resonated with you, post a review on iTunes to increase the range of our spells. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. When he came around, tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess who saved herself.
This has been the Mythgreens Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Coulton.